I think it's quite true to say that we in the Western world have for centuries looked upon Christianity as the only religion. And we have even persecuted those few brave people who have set out to study other religions. We have failed, in a way, to realize that people of every religion naturally find fulfillment of their spiritual needs in following that particular religion which belongs to them in that country at that time. All religions have importance to some people throughout the world. History records that a small number of extraordinary human beings who seem to possess in fullest measure those intellectual and spiritual values which sustain civilization have been born in countries throughout the world from time immemorial. And these are the great spiritual teachers. And their lives are inspiring records of unselfish dedication to the great needs of mankind. And the message and teaching they have brought has in each case been exactly tailored to suit the requirements of that particular age and the people living in that part of the world at that particular age. And it's also a mark of true spiritual teaching that the teaching has a practical application in that it improves the way of life for those to whom it is addressed. That these teachers taught, that which these teachers taught was often a revitalized and purified form of previous religions, beliefs, and rituals, and was almost always based on the teaching of those who had gone before, but an extension and a revision of those teachings. Now, this is true of Christianity, which, if you look into the question, came largely from the Jewish faith. And again, Mohammedanism came from the Christian faith, and Buddhism came from the Hindu faith. Theosophy has always maintained that there is a core of essential knowledge in every religion, and those who seek can find the universal religion in any, the universal wisdom in any religion, regardless of the incrustations of superstition and the restrictions of dogma. And there is good reason to claim that the spiritual teachers were divinely inspired, provided we understand carefully what is meant by divine inspiration. Many believe that there are perfected men called adepts who have an immeasurably wider vision of life and its meaning than we do. They are agents of the one unifying beneficent principle, which, if you like, we can call God. It seems that when there is a critical period in the cultural and religious life of mankind, and a need for their help and guidance, these adepts either take incarnation as men and become spiritual teachers themselves, or they inspire and help a particular person living in the world to teach their message by word and example. Some of these great spiritual teachers have become mythical figures without historic records of their lives. In this category is Hermes, or Thoth, Orpheus, Krishna, and Zoroastra, or Zarathustra. It's the same person. But others are historical persons, the life of Buddha is well documented. So is that of Lao Tzu of China and the Mohammed. And some of the others are in between. Now, in getting a list of 12 spiritual teachers, it is inevitable that some have to be left out and some put in that we may perhaps feel are unworthy of a place. But the list which I have prepared tonight is Hermes, or better known as Thoth, or Tahuti, the Egyptian teacher, Orpheus of the Greeks, Zoroastra of Persia, Krishna of India, Moses, the Jewish faith, Buddha, Quetzalcoatl of Mexico, Lao Tzu of China, Confucius of China, Pythagoras of Greece, Jesus, our Christian teacher, and Muhammad. There are others, as I said, but somehow you feel that these men have influenced a greater number of people in their lives than have some of the others. These teachers seldom wrote down their teachings themselves, and it was left to their followers to record their words with varying degrees of accuracy. And man himself has destroyed many of these written records. Alexander the Great destroyed the libraries of Persepolis in Persia. And why that man is ever called great, I don't know. If you read his life, he was a barbarian of the worst possible type. And the greatest possible loss to the world was the burning of the Alexandrian libraries in Egypt. There were 40,000 rolls or parchments in the Seraphim, and 500 rolls and parchments, documents, records in the Brucium, and the majority of these were unique throughout the world. Even then, those days, 2,000 years ago, or nearly 2,000 years ago, there was evolved there a catalogue system, and the libraries were first class. And Julius Caesar sailed into Alexandria in 47 BC and burnt the Brucium library with the Egyptian fleet. He burnt them both together. Later on, the Roman emperors, Diocletian and Aurelian, again raised the libraries which had been restocked in the meantime. And finally, the Christian mobs pillaged the Seraphim and destroyed what was left. So by about 300 AD, the whole of that library was destroyed. And we have today only small fragments of the writings of many of the Neoplatonists. Because at that time, Alexandria was the cultural center of the world. It is there that the word theosophy comes. They studied Theosophia, God wisdom, those teachings which are now today the Theosophy that Madame Blavatsky, our founder, put before the world. And she, Madame Blavatsky, intended that members of the Theosophical Society should study comparative religion without any of the prejudices that separate various sects and members of various religions. And this was achieved by the Neoplatonists in Alexandria at that time. They were far more tolerant than ourselves. You may know some of the names. Philo-Judaeus, the Jew. Ammonius Saccas, who was a Christian but studied the Hermetic tradition. Origen, a devout Christian. His teaching of reincarnation and other ideas that belong to the original Theosophy were declared heretical by Justinian in 553 AD, as the Christian church closed in with its dogmas to hold back the understanding of a universal religion. Plotinus Iamblichus. And many of these were initiates of the mystery schools of Greece and the temple schools of Egypt. And there was free cultural contact between all the peoples of the world at that time. There were Essenes from Mount Carmel, the Dead Sea, and there were Therapeutes from, most of them lived almost within Alexandria. And they met together in Alexandria. There were Greeks and Romans. There were Persians, the Magi of Chaldea. There were Buddhists. There was a Buddhist monastery on the Nile at that time. There were Hindu Brahmins. There were Jews, and there were the new Christians. Madame Blavatsky says, "The wisdom religion was ever one, and being the last word of possible human knowledge, was therefore carefully preserved. It preceded by long ages the Alexandrian theosophists. It has reached the modern age and will survive every other religion and philosophy." Now, the first of the great teachers that I'm going to talk about belongs to the Egyptian religious tradition, which stretches back thousands and thousands of years. The historian Herodotus and others testify that the Egyptian priests had a recorded history going back 40,000 years. And Solon, the ancestor of Plato, was told by the ancient that the was told about the ancient Greeks who fought and drove off the Atlanteans during the great flood that occurred in the Mediterranean, probably 9,000 years ago. And their history went back further still, and it was all there in astrological and mathematical precision. The pharaohs of Egypt were king priests, and there were religious festivals for the masses, initiation for the few into the inner mysteries. There were periods of true spirituality and periods where black magic dominated. And there is one interesting period where the pharaoh Akhenaten and Nefertiti broke away from the established religion of Amun and set up a new monotheistic religion away from Luxor. He was an amazing man. I haven't called him one of the great spiritual teachers because he influenced only a small number of Egyptians for a small period because he died when he was quite young. But he was a pacifist, a humanitarian, an internationalist, and was well ahead of his time. But the legendary figure down through the mists of time that comes with the knowledge of the Egyptian religion is Tehuti or Thoth. Some of the Egyptian teaching is in the Book of the Dead, but much of the teaching belonged to the mystery schools and has remained a secret to this day. Thoth appears as the personification of wisdom, the very intellect of the great God who formed the world. He is frequently depicted as ibis-headed, that is, with a long pointed beak, and he is shown recording the judgment of the dead before the throne of Osiris, who is taken as the supreme god. He may have been a mortal at some time. He may have lived on earth like a god-man. He most certainly has been deified since that time. And he remains in history as the originator of writing, mathematics, art, religion, chemistry, astrology, and all that made up the Egyptian civilization. The Greeks, who were closely connected with Egypt just across the Mediterranean for these thousands of years BC, adopted Hermes as their name for Thoth. Hermes Trismegistus, Hermes Thrice Greatest, was the name they gave to him. And they recorded his teachings, especially in a book called the Divine Pymander. But this was not written until 200 years AD, sometimes called the Divine Vision. And in it is given this glimpse of those teachings as seen through the Greek mind. Supreme mind fashioned man and bestowed upon him one of the qualities of that divine mind, and gave him seven natures, seven principles, consciousness on seven planes of being. But man looked down into the physical world and forgot his kinship with the light of the supreme mind. And man must now look back towards that light of the supreme mind and must return out of the life in which he is imprisoned in the physical world back to his true relationship with the supreme mind, with their concept of God. This, of course, is theosophy, put in another way. The central teaching of Thoth has survived in Egyptian, as it has survived in Egyptian history, emphasized light, the true light which lighteth every man who cometh into the world, and this is Osiris, because the Egyptians took the sun as the symbol of God. And he dwells in the heart of every man. And the light is hidden everywhere. It is in every rock and in every stone. All comes forth from the light, and to the light all shall return. Look for the light in your own heart. Follow the light. Thou art the light. Let that light shine. Let us pass now to the second of those great teachers. This is a little more difficult because I'm referring to the Indo-European civilization, the Caucasian civilization to which we belong. Its beginnings are also lost in the mists of time. The rishis, or divine teachers, taught in the sensar language of ideographs, which are symbols of things which were heard or realized by an inner voice. In this way, the ancient Vedas were taught. And we have no recorded teacher of the Vedas. Vyasa is sometimes considered to be the teacher of the Vedas, but the word means scribe, and it really refers to a succession of people who recorded these Vedas and wrote them down in the later Sanskrit language. And from this grew the whole of the Hindu religion, which is based on the Vedas and the Upanishads. And their central teachings are, there was one reality which man shares in his highest spirit. One reality which man shares in his highest spirit. This is the basis of brotherhood. I am that I am. Man, being a self-conscious being, must realize his innate potential divinity during a long series of lives on earth under the law of cause and effect, which in India is called karma. And thirdly, self-discipline and religious duties provide the necessary training for the achievement of this goal. There are two, I think you could call them mythical figures, although their history is recorded, it's not accurately recorded, two mythical figures that play a tremendous part in the life of the Hindus. And they are Rama of the Ramayana and the Krishna, whose life is well known and forms the basis of many of the fairy stories that the Indian children are taught, and of many of their cultural songs, dance dramas, and so on. I have taken Krishna as one of the world teachers because his influence is still so strong in India. He is closely allied to our concept of a Christ figure, for he represents the love-wisdom aspect of religion. And there is an exactly laid out story of his birth, which was miraculously, he was miraculously saved and taken away out to and to a foster parent, because otherwise he hadn't been, he would have been killed, because there was a decree that he, every baby that time should be killed. He grew up as a child that was absolutely at one with all nature. He expressed the love aspect, and with his consort Radha was one with all the gopis, the maidens, of the peasant maidens and so on. But that is just symbolic of his expression of the love nature. And then there is the story where he overcame the great reptile in the river Jamnu by, in the end, he pranced on its head, on the center of its seven heads, and completely subjugated it. This means, of course, that he subjugated his lower nature and he aroused the force of Kundalini, which gave him the tremendous powers that go with its awakening, tremendous spiritual powers. And the best picture of Krishna is in the Bhagavad Gita, where he is the charioteer for Arjuna. And he tells Arjuna, in the midst of the battle, which is a battle, the battle of life, the battle between spiritual forces and the lower forces of the personality, where he instructs Arjuna in yoga, skill in action, and shows him the way by which he can overcome his lower nature and rise to an understanding of his true spiritual nature, which is yoga, and become one with all life, and ultimately to experience enlightenment. It's a wonderful story. Many of you will know it. There was no other real outstanding historical teacher. Kapila wrote down Sankara, that branch of the Hindu philosophy. Sankaracharya wrote down the Vedanta, and Patanjali wrote down Raja Yoga. But beyond Krishna, there isn't really any great figure, great teacher. Now, on the other side of the mountains, another Indo-European race developed the teachings of the Vedas. And they developed them as the Zend Avesta, the sacred writings of ancient Persia, the same source. And here the great teacher was Zarathustra, or Zoroaster, a legendary figure perhaps. His exact life cannot be actually pinpointed, and some suggest that there were many Zoroastras, that it was, as it were, an office held by successive persons. He taught that Ahura Mazda, Mazda is the name we've got in the Japanese car and the light bulbs and things. It's amazing how this has come down to us. He taught that Ahura Mazda is the invisible pure spirit, the ever-present, eternal, and all-pervading reality. This is symbolized as the one creative radiance, which is fire, which burns and purifies all that is not truth. Zarathustra taught his pupils that man's inner self ever burns with the light of intelligence and the emotions of pure love, but man must actualize these potentials in his living. His teaching was carried on by the Magi, as they are called, the great astrologers and astronomers and mathematicians of Chaldea. And later, from Zoroastrianism, came the Mithraic mysteries and the Mithraic teachings, which incorporated a sort of a military-like concept of chivalry and discipline. And the Roman soldiers took the Mithraic rituals and religious ideas throughout the whole world. And there were Mithraic temples in London, and one of them was recently discovered when they were digging the excavations of another building. And today, the Parsis in India still follow the Zoroastrian teachings. Now, between these two streams, the one of the West being the Egyptian, and the one of the East being the Indo-European, there is a legendary teacher called Orpheus. Some Orphic hymns exist in fragments, and they indicate a fusion of the Hermetic or Egyptian tradition and that of the Vedas. Orpheus is supposed to have lived in northern Greece, and he's always pictured with his flute to symbolize by sound the wondrous harmony that is in all things, just the same as Krishna is always pictured. Life is beauty, life is joy, and all creation resounds to the harmony of the creative word. His inner teachings are little known because they belong to the initiates and form the core instructions in the Greek mystery school. He may have lived as a person, and in fact, there are historical remnants which suggest that 5 men bore the name of Orpheus. He was certainly a priest initiate and taught the sacred wisdom, the secret doctrine. To him, God was revealed as an eternally abiding good, an ever-flowing fountain of truth and law, omnipotent unity and an omniscient reality. To him, and this is most interesting, to him, deity was not being, but the source of being. Deity was not mind, but the source of mind, and the hidden origin of all revealed things. Madame Blavatsky said that his lyre was 7-stringed, and these represented the 7-fold mystery of initiation, or that they represent the 7 principles in man's soul, or as I said before, the 7 ways in which consciousness functions through his vehicles. And he, I believe, taught that reincarnation was necessary so that man could, by successive experiences in the physical world, come to an understanding of these great truths. Pythagoras and Plato, who was his pupil, were initiates, and the Orphic tradition is expounded in their teachings. The history of the great teacher of the... I'm sorry, I'll just make that comment because I'll come back to Pythagoras later. We next pass to the teacher of the Jews, Moses, and his life is authenticated, although there is some divergence of opinion as to when he actually lived. It's probably about 1300 BC. And his initial teachings were based on those of the Egyptians. I have seen comment that the 10 commandments are almost identical with those given in the Egyptian Book of the Dead. And the Kabbalah and the Zohar contain the Jewish esoteric teachings, and we can still read them. Moses taught a lofty concept of the one God and practical rules of life. And when he was expelled from Egypt and later from Jerusalem and was made, and the Jews themselves were made slaves in Persia, they learnt much of the teaching of the Persians, of the Zoroastrians. So all through their lives, all through the history of the Jewish race, there has been this tendency to stand alone and to fight for their existence. And unfortunately, some of this attitude towards life has carried over into Christianity as the concept of a revengeful God and the doctrine of an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But in the esoteric Jewish teaching that you will get in the Kabbalah, many of those great truths which are common to all religions can be found. 600 years BC was a glorious age in world history when several great spiritual teachers were spreading their messages in different parts of the world. Pythagoras in Greece, lived in Greece about this time. He spent 20 years in Egypt, being taught all that he could by the initiates of the Egyptian mystery schools. Some say he went to India and met the Buddha. He described God as supreme mind, the cause of all things, the intelligence and the power of all things. And he taught his disciples by mathematics. He used the Platonic solids as a method of showing the divine order that is in the universe that God geometrizes. And this is part of the great order that we find throughout all manifestation. He used the tetrad, the ten in a triangle, 1, 2, 3, and 4, as a method of imparting spiritual teachings, which I can't have time to go into tonight. He had a famous school at Crotona when he moved from Samos and Greece. He was born in Samos. He moved to Crotona in Italy. And in that school, those who joined had to keep silence for 3 years. This is probably one of those schools of teaching of the inner mysteries which we have most knowledge. He left no writing himself, but his golden verses still exist. I don't think they are the originals that he gave them. They again were written down by his followers. And Iamblichus, who lived 500 or so years later, leaves us with today with a very exact history or biography of the life of Pythagoras. And it was Plato, living a bit later, who carried the Greek concepts of life into the Western world, where they have formed the basis for so much of our concept of art and of law and of all the organization that goes to make up Western civilization. Now also, about 623, now I think it's exactly 623 years BC, there was born in India the Buddha. He was born in a time of social corruption, and he brought to India a message of compassion and stressed the right values in life. He was born a prince, but after seeing suffering in the city and outside the palace, he sought an understanding of sorrow and pain and ultimately reached the experience of enlightenment. And when he did this, he understood the nature and the cause of the suffering and pain. He portrayed the nature of these. He portrayed the cessation of sorrow as the destruction of desire for unattainable objects. Desire to him was the product of the passions of the lesser self. The way in which man may work out his salvation, independent of God, priest, or ritual, is set out in the Noble Eightfold Path, the steps of which you will probably all know. The doctrine of charity, equality, and a non-attachment to material things, and the doctrine of ahimsa, non-violence to living things, was taught as a means by which all men will in time attain to nirvana. Nirvana being the ultimate bliss, the ultimate realization of unity, of one with all. Buddhism expanded out of India to Tibet, to China, and to Southeast Asia. And there was a revival of Hinduism within India itself. This is very interesting indeed. Now, about the same time, about 500, 600 BC, there were two great spiritual teachers in China. It is said that they probably actually met one another. The first was Lao Tzu, and he was born 604 BC, and he taught Taoism. He taught it as a way of life based on the divine plan which underlies all nature. True action is attained through inaction or passivity, and this carried into Zen Buddhism. You can see its effect, one fusing with the other. Man is to become self-sufficient and not rely on wealth, prestige, and artificial social life. And his followers were taught to quieten their senses and appetites and to gain an inner perception of the Tao, to achieve harmony with the oneness of the eternal principle, which underlies the whole world. This Tao he looked upon as the ultimate truth, the undefinable God. Confucius, who lived a few years later, also taught the way of the Tao, but stressed moral order and the right way of personal conduct. He is best known, of course, for his humor. Confucius said, pithy maxims and wisdom, and the sayings of Confucius brought hope and happiness into the lives of many Chinese at that time, and still inspire many Chinese. Next, I want to speak about who lived probably about, it's very hard to say when he actually lived, is Quetzalcoatl in Mexico, the feathered snake, the god, semi-god, demigod, man-god, with a snake headdress. It probably was also an office, and there were probably many who held this office, but they were initiates, and what they taught is very similar to that which was taught in the Orphic tradition, in the Hermetic tradition, and by the Buddha, and so on. It's interesting to note that in that what remains, the few documents that do remain, which indicate the life of Quetzalcoatl, there is a tradition of crucifixion and resurrection. And I believe that in some of the lives of some of the other teachers, there is also this tradition of crucifixion and resurrection. It was 600 years later that Jesus the Christ was born in Palestine, and he taught Christian charity. He also called on the higher self within, the fullness of the Christ, which lighteth every man that cometh into the world, and exhorted his disciples to rise to the fullness of the perfection of the Christ. Some cannot accept the doctrine of vicarious atonement and that man can be saved by mere belief, but there is much evidence that his esoteric teachings were suppressed by the church fathers, although some are still in the Bible expressed in allegory. And if you read Mr. Hodson's book on the hidden wisdom in the Holy Bible, you will be able to follow through many of these truths which are hidden, as it were, in allegory. But the Bible itself is actually a collection of oral teachings selected late in the 2nd century AD, because like many of the other great spiritual teachers, there are no actual writings from Jesus himself, which are available to us today. Now the last of the great teachers was Muhammad, who lived in the 6th century AD. His religion grew out of Christianity. Allah is a monotheistic God, and Islam means bowing down to the will of God. And today, the Muslims bow in all humility, sincerity, and reverence to Allah at sunrise, sunset, and sometimes at midday. The purest esoteric form of the Muslim faith is today preserved by the mystic Sufi sect. It embodies all the teachings of the ancient wisdom which have been given to the world by the great teachers and is very worthy of study. And there are books in our library which you can read about the Sufi teachings. The teachings which consist or make up the ancient wisdom could be summarized in this way. There is one all-embracing unity which can be conceived as God, in which we live and move and have our being. And secondly, the highest principle in man is a fragment of this one unity. Therefore, all men are brothers and share the one consciousness. And thirdly, because of the unity of all life, all that lives shares this one consciousness. And fourthly, the purpose of life is the more and more perfect expression of this one reality in every aspect of life and in the life of every living unit of that one reality. It can be summed up in the very beautiful phrase that belongs to the three great truths that have been set forth by the society for so many years. Every man is his own absolute lawgiver, the dispenser of glory or gloom to himself, the decreer of his life, his reward, and his punishment. I'd like just to read quickly the expressions of the golden rule of action as they exist or have been recorded in the various religions by these great teachers. In Christianity, all things whatsoever you would that man should do to you, do you even so to them, for this is the law and the prophets. And in Buddhism, you'd be amazed at the similarity of these quotations. In Buddhism, hurt not others with that which pains yourself. And Confucius, is there any one maxim which ought to be acted upon throughout one's life? Surely the maxim of loving kindness is such, do not unto others what you would not they should do unto you. And the Hebrew, what is hurtful to yourself, do not to your fellow man. That is the whole of the Torah, and the remainder is but commentary. Go learn it. What a beautiful expression. What is hurtful to yourself, do not to your fellow man. That is the whole of the Torah, and the remainder is but commentary on that. Go learn it. And that's from the Talmud. Hinduism, this is the sum of duty. Do naught to others, which if done to thee, would cause thee pain. From the Mahabharata, in which the Bhagavad Gita comes. In Islam, no one of you is a believer until he loves for his brother what he loves for himself. And in Taoism, regard your neighbor's gain as your own gain, and regard your neighbor's loss as your own loss. And in Zoroastrianism, that nature only is good, which shall not do unto another whatever is not good for its own self. And in closing, may I express the hope that from the awakening of a recognition of spiritual values, which appears to be coming to the world today, in the rapidly changing conditions in which we find ourselves, I express the hope that there will arise a worldwide universal religion based on the teachings of these great world teachers. The wisdom teachings, which are changeless. The formulating of such a universal religion and the principles which it must contain and which must be acceptable to the peoples of all nations is a formidable undertaking. But what else is more necessary in the world today, and what is more worthwhile? And I suggest that if we study the ancient wisdom set forth in theosophy, we can find the basis for such a worldwide, universally accepted religion.